Food prices have increased over 40%. Energy prices have increased over 20%. Wheat and gas prices have increased over 70%. What's going to be next? Do you see these trends reversing or even stabilizing? All fiat currencies have always failed and collapsed their economies on their way down. The Roman Empire, China, France, Argentina, Finland, Mexico, Russia, Zimbabwe all tried fiat currency and all collapsed into chaos. Meanwhile, the dollar has lost over 97% of its gold value since 1971, when an ounce of gold was valued at $35. If your assets are in paper, you are in danger. Protect your assets with gold and silver. Visit Discount Gold and Silver Trading at DGScoins.com. That's DGScoins.com or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188. Protect yourself and your family.
Ladies and gentlemen, you are listening to Financial Survival, and I'm Melody Cederstrom. My co-host, Alfred Addis, he's off today. But we did work late last night. We interviewed James Corbett of the Corbett Report, lead writer for the International Forecaster, late last night. And as soon as I finished with the market report for Thursday, May 15th, 2014, of course, you will hear the interview. Wendy Wilson, who normally joins us today, will be here Friday for her 20-minute segment. So let's get started right away. Gold today had a troubling day. It tried, but I think she will be back strong tomorrow. You have gold down $9 today at $1,297. Silver was down 27 cents today at $19.57, along with platinum down 15 at $14.70. Palladium down 16 at 814. All your white metals were down over 1%. Gold down almost 0.75%. So gold actually did fare a little bit better today. The USDX today was down 0.03 at 80.03. So just teetering on that 80 level. You have oil down almost a full dollar, 0.87 at 101.50. And it looks like the fear is back in the markets. And, you know, we talk about the fear and greed index. And before we get to the final numbers on the paper markets, we talked about the fear and greed index. And the fear and greed today stands at 23. And that's just down from yesterday's previous close, 38, so it's a big drop today. But what I think is real interesting is 1 year ago today, it was extreme greed at 87. So a big change in 1 year, and you had the Dow down almost a little more than 200 points today in afternoon trading. Of course, the S&P and the NASDAQ both fell. They did come back off their lows, though, on the day. You have the Dow down 166 points at 16,447. The NASDAQ down 31 at 4,069. The S&P down 17 at 1870. And the 10-year yield, 2.50%. You had investors, they rushed into bonds today, drove the yield on the 10-year Treasury to 2.48% at one time. and that's the lowest level we've seen since October of last year. And of course, I think we're seeing a shift from the recent trend when you have both the Dow and the S&P hitting a string of record closings this week with the, as I mentioned, the S&P crossing the 1900 mark for the first time on Tuesday. Even the European markets, they were also under pressure. A lot of mixed economic data from the Eurozone. You had stocks in Italy, Ireland, and Spain. They all fell sharply. Even Germany and France, they both ended down 1%. And of course, if you had to point to something, there was poor earnings that came out from Walmart, and I'll bet you'll never know what they were going to blame it on as far as their bad results. It was hurt by bad weather and a delay in tax refunds. Of course, they're blaming that on the government shutdown from last fall. But how would you like to have a business where a large part of it, in order for you to make your investors happy, tax refunds? You're betting on tax refunds. So I don't know. I just think there's something wrong with that. Anyway, Kohl's came out. They also had bad news. Their sales fell 3.4% in the first quarter. And actually, you know, the street always comes out with expectations, and it's not that difficult to beat the street's expectations. But when a company even missed their own expectations, that's something a little bit different. JCPenney tonight, Nordstrom, they're all coming out with their quarterly reports after the market closes. GM came out today, announced another 5 new recalls covering 2.7 million vehicles. And of course, we all know that's including the wiring flaw that was tied to 13 accidents and a couple of injuries. Government said new claims for unemployment benefits fell in the week, ending May 10th. Consumer prices, we talked about PPI yesterday. Well, the CPI came out today. That increased 0.3%. And, of course, you exclude that food and energy. And, of course, it rose 0.2% last month. I didn't even have a chance to look at all the breakdowns on that report press. We'll go into that a little bit more tomorrow. The Federal Reserve industrial production fell 0.6% in April, and manufacturing activity in New York area, that came in above expectations, while the activity in Philly slowed. And, of course, tonight you have Janet Yellen. She's talking about business and the economy in Washington this evening. So that's pretty much a wrap. We're going to be heading to the interview in about a minute. We do have a 90% special. James Corbett is the lead writer for the International Forecaster. So our special today is 90% silver. It includes a one-year subscription to the International Forecaster. It also includes your shipping, $50 face value of 90% silver for $965. That's it, out the door. And you also get a one-ounce silver eagle, so that's also included. So it's really a good special. It's a great interview, but you must call us at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Visit our website at dgscoins.com, dgscoins.com. So we'll be back tomorrow, and the interview will be starting here in just 2 seconds. Thank you for joining us.
I'm going to introduce our guest, James Corbett. He is the editor, webmaster of the Corbett Report. He's been living and working in Japan since 2004, started the Corbett Report in 2007 as an outlet for independent critical analysis of politics, society, history, and economics. In other words, James, it sounds like you can't quite make up your mind what you want to focus on.
That's exactly right, and that's the whole point of starting the website. I didn't want to focus on anything, so I'll do everything.
All right. Well, it's a pleasure to have you on the program again tonight.
Yes.
What do you think is what's hot in the news that people should be interested in and concerned about right now that maybe they haven't heard about?
Well, why don't we pick up from what I was writing about in the most recent edition of the International Forecaster? My recent editorial is up there at the internationalforecaster.com, and I was writing about some recent stunning admissions from not only the New York Fed president, but also the Dallas Fed president, who made a couple of comments which, when taken together, I think are pretty astounding, or at least should be astounding to people who've been following the propaganda surrounding the Federal Reserve's quantitative easing program, this quantitative easing to infinity, where they're just continuing to print money and inject it into the system through the purchase of toxic mortgage assets and also outright buying of bonds, which they are now starting to taper. Of course, it was originally an $85 billion a month program. Now they're down to $45 billion a month. But back in early 2014, the New York Fed President Bill Dudley said at a meeting in Philadelphia, quote, "We don't understand fully how large-scale asset purchase programs work to ease financial market conditions," end quote. So that's a direct admission that the Federal Reserve really doesn't know what it's doing with QE, but it appears to be working, so I guess that's a good thing, insofar as the markets have been propped up for the last 6 years in this unprecedented bull market that we've seen that is continues to reach new record highs on the DJIA and the S&P. Taken together with what the Dallas Fed President Richard Fisher just recently said at the Louisiana Bankers Association's 114th Annual Convention and Expo, he said, quote, "I am often asked why I do not support a more rapid deceleration of our purchases, given my agnosticism about their effectiveness and my concern that they might be leading to froth in certain segments of the financial markets. The answer is an admission of reality. We juiced the trading and risk markets so extensively that they became somewhat addicted to our accommodation of their needs," end quote. So again, once again, this is a pretty stunning black and white admission from a president of one of the Federal Reserve banks of what people like myself and yourselves and many others have been talking about for a very long time, that the quantitative easing program, what the Federal Reserve is doing, is basically injecting steroids into the market. And at the point at which they stop taking those steroids away, all of this phony, fake, imaginary wealth that's been created in the markets over the past 6 years is going to collapse. The air is going to come out of the edifice. The bubble is going to pop. And this is a pretty black and white admission from two of the senior members of the Federal Reserve itself. So I think we should probably take this into account when we're deciding what the overall health of the American economy is at this particular time.
Does anyone really know what's going on? Is anyone in charge who understands what they're doing? Anyone who follows this, you've seen articles where people, they're quoted as saying we are in uncharted territory. We're in places we've never been before. Nobody really seems to know what's going on. And yet, who is in control? Is it illusion? What do you think?
Well, I'd like to. I don't know which is a scarier prospect, actually. The idea that no one's in control and they're all just kind of going along in uncharted territory, or the fact that there are people in control who are actually engineering what we're seeing happening. Perhaps that's the more fundamentally scary idea, because that raises the idea that we have been engineered into a bubble economy precisely so that that bubble can be popped at a time that is most opportune for the people who are inflating the bubble, which is unfortunately something we've seen many, many times before, including, of course, the great contraction of the money supply in the early 1930s by the Federal Reserve at that time, which, of course, caused the Great Depression and mass unemployment and starvation and poverty for the masses of the people. But, of course, in any time like that, the wealth that was previously there wasn't destroyed. It was just transferred. And the very, very wealthy who were well-placed and who mysteriously managed to get rid of most of their holdings in the stock market before the 1929 crash somehow ended up benefiting from that Great Depression. And basically, even if wealth evaporates, the power that underlies that wealth doesn't necessarily. So I think that's the real concern I have about what's happening right now, is that the people who are running these QE programs, despite what they protest, I think they are smart enough to understand what is happening and what are the likely consequences of this. And in fact, we had a senior Bank of England official come out last year to admit that the Bank of England and the Federal Reserve and these other central banks that are inflating the quantitative easing bubble have intentionally inflated the largest bond bubble in history, and that these types of things generally don't work well when they start to come to an end. So I think that we are being prepared for the popping of a bubble that has been created with the conscious forethought that at some point it will have to come to an end. And I think that's specifically for the purpose of engineering us into a new normal, a new type of economy. And on the way there, of course, we are going to see some very bizarre things happening, including the new normal that we've seen for a few years now, that good news for the markets is treated as bad news by the markets and vice versa. So that, for example, here in Japan, we just had the release of the latest first quarter GDP results, which were much higher than expected. Yay! Except, unfortunately, for the people invested in the Japanese equities markets, that means that now the Bank of Japan and the Japanese government don't have an excuse to extend their quantitative easing program, so they probably won't do so when that comes up for review next month. And as a result, people are going to start pulling their money out of the equities markets. So good news is bad news. Bad news is good news. We've seen this in the United States, in the Eurozone, in Japan, in many other markets besides. And that's a sign of a market that is so fundamentally manipulated and turned on its head that it doesn't know which way is up or which way is down, what's black or what's white. And once you start getting into that type of territory, I think all bets are off the table in terms of when this collapse is going to happen or precisely, you know, how it's going to start or which dominoes will be the first to fall. But that it is going to happen, I think, is beyond doubt at this point.
And the implication is we're not talking about going through a wave where everybody gets wet. We're talking about a hole in the side of the ship that's going to probably cause something like the Titanic. We're going to see something dramatic and painful and potentially lethal take place, not just an inconvenience. You know, you mentioned earlier you were talking about the wealth was transferred during the Great Depression. But if we go into another depression, back then we had gold and silver coin as the backbone for our money system. Today, we have only debt for the backbone of our money system. And if the debt is shown to be invalid, if it's not paid, there won't be a transfer of wealth per se. Wealth will be destroyed. One man's debt is another man's asset. And if he can't pay his debt, his asset that someone's holding, someone's got a piece of paper with a signature on it, says it's worth $100,000, and he says, I have an asset. He's going to find out, no, he has just a piece of paper. It's not like gold or silver. Do you follow what I'm saying?
I do indeed, and I think you're right to point that out, because the notional value of the world economy is many, many, many times the actual value of the real assets underlying it. Mm-hmm. And we can see that most obviously in the derivatives bubble, which, I mean, it's anyone's guess really what the absolute value of all of these derivatives are, but the number of $1 quadrillion has been floated. But no one really knows, because these are so leveraged out that the unwinding of them are almost this unthinkable event that would basically bring down the entire world economy many times over. And this is the difference between real value and notional value. And of course, the notional value is really just an imaginary number. I mean, you could just write a one with a number of zeros after it. It doesn't mean that wealth actually exists. So you're right in that, that from that perspective. But
the
I think
debt goes down, we're going to lose the paper wealth. And where do we find the capital? Where do we find the capital to rebuild?
Right. But I think
after the paper wealth disappears.
Well, I think it's important to look at wealth not from the perspective of the assets or the things that underlie it, but in terms of the power relationship that these numbers on paper or these ones and zeros bring, because it's ultimately about that relationship between the debtor and the creditor, which you were talking about earlier. And when the debtor finds himself in a position to be unable to pay back a loan or the credit that's been extended to him, then he becomes in the service, in the debt servitude of the creditor. And I think it's that power relationship where the quote-unquote wealth effect really lies. This is what is ultimately underneath.
Well, let's talk about that in a couple of minutes. Let's talk a little further about where the wealth really lies when we return to Financial Survival. I'm Alfred Addisk here with Melody Cederstrom and James Corbett from the Corbett Report. We'll be right back. Please stay tuned.
The aspirin mistake. Aspirin was discovered by mistake during World War II and suppresses your immune system and prevents blood clotting. Don't expose your body to risk when you can use a natural inflammation and pain reliever called Extra Strength Pain Relief by Apothecary Herbs. Discover the power this formula has with Salicin to enter the system in 60 seconds to work hard and relieve pain for 12 hours. Whether it's arthritis, sports injury, or flu, you can relieve aches, pain, and swelling with our Extra Strength Pain Relief formula. Call Apothecary Herbs now, toll-free, 866-229-3663. That's 866-229-3663. International callers dial 704-875-8010 or order online at www.thepowerherbs.com.
Food prices have increased over 40%. Energy prices have increased over 20%. Wheat and gas prices have increased over 70%. What's going to be next? Do you see these trends reversing or even stabilizing? All fiat currencies have always failed and collapsed their economies on their way down. The Roman Empire, China, France, Argentina, Finland, Mexico, Russia, and Zimbabwe all tried fiat currency and all collapsed into chaos. Meanwhile, the dollar has lost over 97%. Of its gold value since 1971, when an ounce of gold was valued at $35. If your assets are in paper, you are in danger. Protect your assets with gold and silver. Visit Discount Gold and Silver Trading at DGScoins.com. That's DGScoins.com or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188. Protect yourself and your family.
American Voice Radio Network is heard on Galaxy 19 at 97 degrees west, transponder 23, frequency 12115, audio PID 2595. AVR is heard on the left side audio channel, and AVR 2 is heard on the right side audio channel. Remember, both AVR and AVR 2 are on Galaxy 19. Same network, double the choices.
I'm Alfred Addis here with Melody Cederstrom on Financial Survival, and our guest is James Corbett, who's calling in from Japan. We were talking about the transfer of wealth. Do you want to continue with that, James?
Well, I'm not sure I have much more of a point to make to that, other than to say once again that I think that the idea of wealth as just a numbers on piece of paper or just the value of underlying assets is a limiting concept, because ultimately I think the people who have their hands on the printing presses and can literally create money out of nothing in the form of debt owed back to themselves don't care at the end of the day whether their bank has, you know, 9 zeros after it or 12. At the end of the day, I think they care about the power that money brings with it. And that's the operative part, and that's the part that survives even during times of economic collapse or contraction. So I think we have to be very concerned about that. And of course, that manifests itself in things like what we saw in Cyprus, was it last year, with the bail-in regime, where, of course, the people were asked to bail in the banks. They were asked to take their savings, and anything over the arbitrary amount set by Europe was thrown in to help pay off the debts of the banks that they were supposedly depositing their money in. And that perhaps allowed people to realize that deposits are, of course, not just neutral transactions in which you put your money in the bank's vaults. It's actually you are loaning your money to the bank, and you better trust that they know what they're doing with it, which, of course, they do not. So I hope that the at least the idea has been planted in people who watched what happened there, that this is ultimately not even about debts per se, because of course banks can rack up whatever kinds of debts they want, and they'll be bailed in or bailed out by the governments or the people or whoever it is as need be, because once again, I think they hold the power in that relationship. So I think we have to keep that in mind with whatever's happening in terms of the numbers on the markets going up or down. It's ultimately about where the power lies, and unfortunately it continues to lie and accrue and even gets more concentrated in the hands of the people who I don't think we want it to be concentrated in.
In the event that we see a serious collapse, Is the money going to remain in the hands of, let's say, or is the power going to remain in the hands of the Federal Reserve, for example, the people able to print the paper money, or will it shift to whoever is holding gold or silver?
I think that the long-term plan is to include the, if not the destruction of the Federal Reserve, at least the destruction of the current monetary order in the international financial mm-hmm. order. And I think that includes the death of the dollar as a reserve currency. And I don't see that coming in the near future, barring some sort of cataclysmic event. But I think it's almost inevitable, just looking at the trends that are developing right now. And I think what that means is that at some point in the future, the U.S. dollar will be eclipsed by most likely what has been proposed by a number of nations, including China, have been on board with this idea of replacing it with a basket of currencies, as represented by something like the IMF's special drawing rights, which are instruments that can be used as reserves, and they can be drawn on dollars and or pounds and or yen and or euros. Basically this basket of currencies that underlie it. And I think that's the system we're moving more towards. And in that system, I think countries like China and Russia and many other central banks have been buying gold quite furiously in recent years, I think, in expectation of that changeover. Because in the new paradigm, I think that it will be central banks that can capitalize their fiat money with something, with some sort of precious metal holding or something, will be the ones that will be put in for inclusion in that eventual currency basket that I think will form the basis of future international trade, all things being equal and all things going where we think they're going. And of course, there are any number of, you know, surprising events that could come out of left field to change that. But other than that, I think we all know where this is going. And ultimately, it's towards the creation of a global financial market that will feed into a global tax structure, that will feed into a global governmental system. And that's the direction it's heading in. And unfortunately, I don't think that's going to work out for the vast majority of humanity. But it's mm-hmm. difficult to see how, for the average individual, how we can put the brakes to that agenda.
What happens, what I'm curious, what interests me is if the system collapses. Most people probably don't know what a fiat currency is. But in the event that the currency, the United States dollar, collapses, I think everybody's going to understand that fiat currency is a bad word. Can they be persuaded to accept another fiat currency? Give up the paper dollar to take a paper basket of currencies?
I think it would be surprising to find just what people are willing to accept in times of crisis. And I think anything that offers the modicum of stability or the maintenance of the status quo, people will flock to. And that's unfortunate, but I think that's a fact of if not human nature, at least the conditioning that we've been under for a very long time now. And you point out the difference between the 1930s situation in the United States, where the population was still predominantly rural and still had access to resources that by which they could provide for themselves and their family and their community. But that infrastructure is almost completely gone now, and the vast majority of the population is urbanized and pretty much unable to fend for themselves in the event of a collapse scenario. But it's important to understand there are also many different ways that collapse can unfold. It doesn't necessarily mean the hyperinflationary debt spiral collapse. There can even be periods of lengthy deflationary processes that go on that ultimately have a very similar effect in terms of the stagnation of the economy. And in fact, that was really the underlying cause of the 1930s depression. It was a contraction of the money supply that was the real culprit there, so that that people just didn't have access to the monetary resources they needed to conduct trade, and that reduced the trade that was going on. So there are different ways this can happen. And again, I think any strongman, any strong institution that comes along saying just take these and everything will be back to normal, I think that a lot of people will jump at that chance, especially as they say, any society or any civilization is only three meals away from revolution. And given the way that, unfortunately, the American populace and the people of the industrialized world have been trained over the past several generations, I think that might have been reduced to one or two meals, or maybe mm-hmm. just a slight snack.
And also, if someone steps up and says, I can put a chicken in every pot, that's going to be enough to get a lot of people to say, yeah, buddy. They'll follow that man who claims he can put one chicken in every pot per week. And it may be enough to And it's sad. It's unfortunate. It's one of those things where you wish you could teach people, teach enough people before the collapse, what kind of government you want to fight for in the aftermath of a collapse. What do we want? If we go in ignorant, we're going to be hustled by people who aren't and are prepared to take advantage. Talking about taking advantage, who's taking advantage of the Ukraine? Is the Ukraine the victim of Russia? Is it the victim of the West? Is it victim of both sides or its own incompetence and corruption?
Yes, 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 and yes.
Yeah, yeah.
I think that the people who are losing in what's happening in Ukraine, as always, are the vast majority of the Ukrainian people. And there are, every side has its stake in the country and has its own agenda and what it's angling for and what it wants to achieve. And I think in every case, it's just carving up the country and the people and tearing it apart. And to a certain extent, maybe you can argue that maybe the social fabric, the economic fabric of the country was prone to being torn apart. I mean, this was not necessarily a nation of people who always got along or saw eye to eye or thought of themselves as one coherent whole in the first place. But whatever it is, I mean, certainly it's being torn apart right now at the seams. And that, again, is not going to be good news for the vast majority of people in the country. And and we can definitely point to the coordinated actions of the United States, the State Department, which has admitted $5 billion of funding over the past 20 years in the promotion of democracy promoting groups in the country, which have been certainly instrumental in helping to organize what's happening there in Kiev. But also, of course, the IMF now getting its debt claws into the country and trying to direct even the political future of the country by attaching stipulations to the new bailout package, including if the eastern portions of the country start to split off or if there's unrest there, then the country will not continue to receive IMF funding. So that's kind of the sword of Damocles hanging over the interim government's head to continue its quote-unquote anti-terrorism operations, which we've already seen result in such things as the Odessa massacre. And I think it would also be naive to say that Russia doesn't have its own geopolitical stake in this game. Of course, it has its interest in eastern Ukraine, not only because of the Russian-speaking population there, but also, I mean, it is the industrial heartland of the country that includes many of the manufacturing plants that manufacture, among other things, a lot of the military equipment that even Russia buys from those plants, including not just the old Soviet T-35 tanks and things like that, but now the modern T-82s and things like this are being produced in that eastern Ukrainian area. So it is important from that perspective. And then on top of all of that, you have, of course, the Ukrainian oligarchy, the oligarchs who have been basically parasiting off of the country for the past couple of decades, cutting deals with whoever will cut deals with them to carve up the country and use its resources and allow pipeline access and other things for, of course, kickbacks and paybacks. And that's been going on for a very long time. And you have the oligarchs now just trying to find their way on top of this pile heap. So, again, every single person in this country has an invested stake in what's going on in one way or another. And again, it's the average Ukrainian person who is going to be feeling the brunt of this. As, for example, just one of the conditions of the IMF bailout that kicked in on May 1st was the ending of a gas subsidy, which the Ukrainian people had previously been enjoying, which was suddenly taken off and prices rising by as much as 50% overnight. So, again, some pretty economically just disastrous things going on for a country that was already on the economic brink. And I don't think anyone is thinking that any of this is going to really solve the fundamental economic problems that the country is going through and has been going through as a result of the oligarchs and the deals that they've been cutting for years and years. So it's a pretty disastrous situation all around.
Are the economics the fundamental motive behind what's behind the conflict over there, or is this more a question of strategic location for possible anti-ICBM rockets?
Well, I would say, yeah.
Is politics predominant or economics?
I don't know if the issues can be separated. I think that they're both very important, and I think the pipelines play into that, and perhaps they're the nexus of the economic and geopolitical aspects of this, because, again, the pipeline politics of Eastern Europe and Central Asia are not only important, but becoming more and more important by the year as these pipelines go into place and start hardwiring and cementing relations between various countries, and they make situations like what's happening in Ukraine right now very dangerous, because it not only affects the economics of the situation, the economic interests of the oligarchs and the other people who are cutting these deals, but it also affects the geopolitical relations between, say, Russia and Europe, and all of the business relations that are stocked on top of that. So you have some interesting things shaking out of this. Like, you have the BP CEO coming out recently and saying, we shouldn't be putting all these sanctions on Russia because, you know, we're operating in the country too, and things like this. So it's making strange bedfellows, and I think that we're starting to see the battle lines forming in a number of different fronts, economically and geopolitically. And you have NATO and the IMF and the Russian government and all of these institutions piling onto this and trying to make whatever geopolitical or economic hay that they can make out of the situation.
Yeah, that's the sad thing about it. Nobody cares how many people get murdered, how many countries, if other than the Ukraine, get destroyed. It's irrelevant. People are just hustling to make a fast buck.
How is it going to end?
That's the billion-dollar question. I think, ultimately, from what I see, I mean, this is just speculation, so take it for what it's worth. But I think that the real action that's happening right now and is going to continue to happen is actually going to happen more in Central Asia and places like this, that are right now peripheral to this discussion, but I think are going to be more important as we start to see some interesting things developing, for example, with countries like Kazakhstan that seem to be being swayed more away from the Russian orbit and more into the sort of NATO country orbit, and Azerbaijan and places like this, where I think the real sort of political maneuvering is going on while everyone's looking at what's happening in Ukraine. And one of the things that I think is going to be exceptionally important to this is coming up next week when Putin makes a state visit to Beijing, and potentially people are rumoring, it seems to be going ahead, they're going to sign a Russia-China pipeline deal, the Power of Siberia pipeline, that's going to be putting upwards of 38 billion cubic meters of gas through that pipeline to China by 2018, and is going to really significantly transform both Russia and China in terms of their gas exports and imports, but not only sort of economically, but also geopolitically, and also in terms of that death of the dollar that we were talking about, because their deal is probably going to be denominated in rubles and yuan, not in dollars. So again, it all feeds into the same situation, and it paints an overall picture of a world that is really changing before our eyes. I mean, this is world historical types of things that are happening right now. And it's difficult to separate what's happening in Ukraine from what's happening with Russia and China and their gas deal and all of these things. They're all of just different pieces of the same puzzle.
Insofar as Russia perceives itself to be opposed by the West, not just Ukraine, but they've got the West on the other side. This is essentially driving Russia over to the east. It's pushing them, it's generating pressure that pushes them toward China. And what's the relationship, if any, with Japan? Does Russia have any significant relationship with Japan that we should be know about?
Well, the Russian-Japanese relations are not exactly happy. They have some territorial disputes with some islands in the northern part of Japan that are still kind of a festering issue. So there isn't a lot of close, happy relationship between them. But it is interesting to note that there was a senior executive at Rosneft, who's seen to be one of Putin's close advisors, who, as Putin was signing the Crimean annexation, was actually in Tokyo talking about how Russia was more and more interested in Asia and investing in Asia and finding Asian outlets for its gas. And we've also seen Russia just recently write off $10 billion of North Korean debt so that it can get access for a pipeline down to South Korea. So and they've also just recently bought Kyrgyz gas for a dollar, because it's in such a ruinous state, and they're going to completely transform and modernize that in Kyrgyzstan. So we're seeing more and more Russia shifting to the east. There's clearly an Asia pivot that's happening on the Russian side of things, and we're going to see the ramifications of that economically and geopolitically more and more in recent years. And in fact,
we'll talk about those ramifications in a moment. Let's break for some more commercial announcements. And Melody and I will be back with James Corbett in just a moment. Please stay tuned.
Denied internet access for their people during civil strife. The FCC seized in-use commercial shortwave frequencies right after the September 11th attacks. No one communication system can be depended on to be there when you need information. You need choices. You need a KU band free-to-air satellite system from AVR. The AVR system includes a receiver, an LNB, and a 75-centimeter dish. All you need to get on your own is the coaxial cable. The system is delivered to your door for $149.99. That's right, delivered for $149.99. That's the shipping and the system, $149.99. Call 541-225-4659. That's 541-225-4659. Or visit AmericanVoiceRadio.com and click Satellite System.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it. Nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it. To secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cederstrom, on American Voice Radio Network and Shortwave Radio. Visit DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
I'm Alfred Addis here with Melody Cederstrom on Financial Survival, and our guest is James Corbett of the Corbett Report. James is located in Japan, and we're talking about ramifications when we broke for commercials a moment ago. Mr. Corbett was talking about ramifications, and I wonder, has Vladimir Putin had cause to think maybe he should have just left the Crimea where it was? In retrospect, is he seeing ramifications that he didn't anticipate? And is he now beginning to think, you know, maybe I should have just left this alone and just gone on with life as it was? Or is he sticking to his guns?
I don't think so. I think at this point, he is probably achieving many of his objectives. At any rate, I don't think the roadblocks that are supposedly being thrown in his way by these sanctions and other things are really having... they are having an effect, but I don't think they're necessarily having the effect that we're led to believe that they're having. And what I mean by that is that when we talk about nations like Russia and others who are now being forced to find other ways to trade without using the U.S. dollar, this isn't a sort of theoretical thing that's happening. This is something that we can really identify and put a name and a face to. For example, I was just looking today at Voice of Russia, which is reporting on a meeting that was convened by the Russian government on April 24th and chaired by the first deputy prime minister of Russia, Igor Shuvalov, who held a de-dollarization meeting talking about ways that the Russian government can start basically finding other export options for its energy reserves, etc., that don't rely on U.S. dollar transactions. And of course, this all hinges on its trading partners being willing to trade in things other than the U.S. dollar. But given that its trading partners are increasingly places like China, who also have an interest in getting rid of their dollar holdings, I think that this is, an identifiable process that's happening right now. And again, I don't think this is a surprising thing. I think that this is perfectly predictable, given the types of the actions that are being taken right now to try to hem Russia in and exclude them from the world community and all of these the other rhetoric that the U.S. State Department is using right now. The only possible logical conclusion of this would be for Russia and China and other nations that feel threatened by these actions to move away from the U.S. dollar. So once again, I think just like with the Federal Reserve QE bubble and other such actions, I think we see the deliberate placing of the U.S. economy and the U.S. dollar into jeopardy. Again, for what I see as a coordinated strategy to at some point bring down the current monetary and financial order in order to replace it with all of these things that are being set up behind the scenes. And one example of that is that we have this OECD initiative. It's a treaty that's now been signed by 47 nations, including Singapore and Switzerland, to share all sorts of intimate banking details of their citizens between those nations in order to, quote unquote, avoid tax evasion by the big corporations. But also, it just happens to apply to individuals. So all of your information, your banking data, your bank balance, your sales and proceeds, etc., are going to be now reportable between this 47 nation bloc as part of what I envision as just another sort of brick in the wall of this facade that's being created of this new global governmental structure. And what could a global government accomplish without a global tax? And how could a global tax possibly go into place if there wasn't international agreements for transparency on banking data and things like this? So again, it's the type of thing that's constructed from 1,000 or 10,000 or a million different bricks. And each individual brick might not look like very much, but taken together, it really does start to create the edifice of a very intimidating structure.
Are all of these bricks being assembled based on a single intelligence that said we need a brick over here and a brick over here and we're going to add bricks every place we look? They might not look like much to the people outside, but there's a single intelligence that's moving this, a single person, a single aristocracy, or are these just the natural consequences that flow from having a certain number of people in a certain number of space, and logic simply compels certain things to take place? Not intelligence necessarily, but a kind of natural evolution.
I would say the answer is somewhere in between those two possibilities. I think that there are elements that we can say are coordinated behind what's happening, and there are elements that are sort of the inevitable result of what's happening. And it's hard to sometimes differentiate the two, but I wouldn't pin this down to a single or a singular intelligence or group of people. I think that this is more an ideology. It's the ideology of globalism. It's the ideology of this mm-hmm. the construction of this global governmental system that many different groups and different people in different countries are working towards in broadly the similar manner, for sometimes very different ends. And I think there are factions within this group that are committed to this ideology that fight with each other. And we do see at times, various elements of this community taking out other elements and things of that nature. But at the end of the day, I think they are striving towards the same system, so that you can see, for example, Putin and Russia consciously modeling the Eurasian Union, which they are currently constructing with some of their trading partners, on the European Union, and even copying wholesale some of the structures of the European Union, including the European Commission. They've just named it the Eurasian Commission, and these types of things. Again, I don't think it necessarily means that Putin is sitting down behind in a closed, smoky room meeting with Merkel and deciding how to carve up the world, so much as it is that the idea of consolidation of power, of globalization, of all of these trends is something that is contagious to people who are in positions of power and want to further consolidate that power. So they will work towards broadly similar ends, sometimes through competing means, sometimes through complementary means, but they all tend to work towards the construction of this system. And so every brick will ultimately interface with the other bricks. It's just a question of who will kind of have control of the building once it's constructed.
I look at it and I wonder, are we seeing a conglomerate of gangs, for lack of they would be corporations, maybe multinational corporations. But are they acting in unison, or are they like gangs that are likely to start wars between themselves, or at least cold wars between themselves? Is there going to be harmony up at the top of this organization that's going to run the world, or will it be a bunch of gangsters stabbing each other in the back when the time is right?
I think the mafia analogy is an apt one, because it really does seem that there are competing crime families that will obviously work together on the points of shared interest and will obviously throw each other under the bus if they think it will help them get ahead. And I would like to hope, I would like to think that ultimately it's that operation, that way of proceeding, that they will be cutthroat and will not hesitate to throw each other to the wolves when it's convenient, that will ultimately make this a system that, even if it does come together, will not cohere, because ultimately there will always be people backstabbing and climbing and clawing their way to try to get into that position of power. So it can't be a coherent whole. I'd like to think that. Unfortunately, I'm not confident in that assertion. So perhaps the global governmental system can be created and constructed, and yes, people might jockey for that position of power, but the position of power will nonetheless remain. I think that it is a quest. I mean, this might sound conspiratorial or what have you, but anyone who knows history knows that that tyrants and people in positions of power since the dawn of civilization have always, and in all cultures and contexts, striven for the creation of larger and larger systems and ultimately world empire. It's what the Caesars were going for. It's what Hitler was going for. I mean, it happens time and time again. And to think that the psychopaths and would-be leaders of our era are any different, I think would be naive.
I can remember seeing a report just a month ago, 6 weeks, I don't recall clearly, dealing with Ukraine. Ukraine reportedly delivered its gold to the United States, presumably to protect it from Russia. I don't recall if it was 100 tons or 1,000 tons. Is that report, have you heard that report? Is the report valid, or am I misinformed?
No, I've heard the report as well, and the details on it were somewhat sketchy, so I'm not sure to what extent we can put faith in this report. But if it were true, it would not surprise me really in the least. This is, of course, the way that these types of operations often play out. And given that it was the U.S. State Department and the IMF and these other clearly U.S. NATO-led organizations that have been behind a lot of the destabilization, certainly in Kiev and in Western Ukraine, then it's only logical to conclude that there would be these types of operations to secure the gold, which is, of course, what we saw in places like Libya, where, you know, Gaddafi's gold somehow went missing during the NATO bombing. And, you know, who knows where it really went to.
There's a lot of people interested in securing the gold. Here, let me help you. I'll take your gold and I'll secure it for you. You're in Japan. How's the Japanese economy functioning right now? What's its short-term, long-term future? And will it have a significant effect on the global or U.S. economy?
Well, on the latter point, I think it definitely will. But to understand what's happening right now, for example, earlier I referenced the first quarter GDP results that recently came out and exceeded expectations, which is now worrying the markets, as I described in that good news is bad news is good news phenomenon. But I think that only paints a very, very inaccurate picture of what's happening, because the first quarter GDP results are a statistical bloop that occurred because the Japanese government here recently raised the national sales tax from 5% to 8% on the 1st of April. Mm-hmm. So my wife and many, many other people in this country besides decided to purchase their big ticket items in the first few months of this year before the tax rate tax rise took place. So there was a lot of front loading of purchasing going on. That's what the first quarter results are about. And we can almost guarantee that the second quarter GDP results are not going to be anywhere near as happy. And on top of that, I mean, the entire Abenomics phenomenon, which is basically just the QE phenomenon copied over to the Bank of Japan, was a lot of hype. And people are, I think, even the most deluded people are now seeing it for what it was and what it is. And in fact, I just tweeted out via my Twitter account a report from Reuters, of all places, talking about Japan's working poor and how the country continues to see poverty rates rising. In fact, some pretty disturbing numbers in terms of single parent mothers and fathers who are now at over 50% poverty, 50% of that group are in technically classified in living in poverty, despite the fact that most of them have jobs. I mean, these are working poor. And that phenomenon is relatively new to Japan. Certainly during the building rebuilding period after the war and then into the bubble period of the 80s and 90s, there was not a huge phenomenon of very large classes of poor people in the country. But that has been steadily rising as the country has stagnated over decades. And this is disturbing because now, of course, we're now over 200% debt to GDP ratio, which is utterly, completely unsustainable. And you're looking at, historically speaking, almost every time that you start to reach those types of debt levels, you do have a default at some point. And if the Japanese government defaults, it's almost an unthinkable situation, not only for Japan, obviously, and the people here, but for the international financial order as it's developed with the yen carry trade. So much of the U.S. dollar and the U.S. markets are supported by that yen carry trade and people borrowing in yen and then investing over in the American markets. And to see that unwind all of a sudden, I think would be pretty damaging for a lot of people. So again, it's a very, very precarious situation we're in. And I think we're going to start seeing that start to unwind over the coming years, perhaps even sooner, depending when the wheels start to fall off this cart.
What's the mindset of the Japanese people? Are they inclined to blame someone for the problems they're experiencing right now, or are they more in a mode of resignation and they're just accepting their fate?
It's interesting because politically this has not reflected back on Prime Minister Abe yet, which is surprising because people who follow Japanese politics, it's basically a game of musical chairs at the Prime Minister level. They change every year or two at best. The last long-term Prime Minister was Junichiro Koizumi back about a decade ago. He lasted for about 5 years, and that was something of a miracle, a Prime Minister actually lasting that long in office. Yet Abe is still there. He's been there for 2 years now and doesn't seem to be showing signs of losing that position anytime in the near future. So people apparently are not, at least not yet, holding Abe or his party really accountable for this economic stagnation that's happening. I think there are still, you know, the leftover residuals of the good feelings that came along with the initial burst of Abenomics and the rising of the markets that came along with that. But the really disturbing part of this is that the Abe government not only brings with it the kind of QE quantitative easing mindset of the Federal Reserve and all of that, but also brings with it an increasing nationalist, militaristic flavor that is playing into the hands of certain sectors of the population over here that are very worried with what's happening with China. So once again,
we'll have to let it go with that because we're about out of time, Jim. I want to thank Jim Corbett for being on the program tonight. And if you want to you want to talk to Jim, why don't you take a look for the Corbett, C-O-R-B-E-T-T report. Google it. Find it.
Let's not forget the international forecaster.
Okay.
James, tell us about the International Forecaster.
Absolutely. Well, people who are interested, I suggest you go to theinternationalforecaster.com. It comes out twice a week. It's an e-newsletter and not only includes an editorial by myself, but also people like Alfred Adask. So of course, you can check that out, theinternationalforecaster.com. You can subscribe there if you want, or you get a free introductory copy if it's your first time.
All right, Jim, thanks very much for being on the program. I'm Alfred Adask here with Melody Cederstrom. We'll be back tomorrow. In the meantime, may the good Lord bless you, me, Melody, Jim, and Frank, the producer.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye.